If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
The prosecution's case against Corey Richens just took another serious hit. Eric's here to talk with us about all of that. And their key witness, Robert Crozier, has now recanted, saying that he never sold fentanyl to the housekeeper at the center of the state's supply chain theory. That single reversal undercuts a narrative that prosecutors have relied on for over a year. But with a toxicology report showing five times a lethal dose of fentanyl, no physical fentanyl recovered, and 26 additional financial crimes on the table, where does this case actually stand? We're going to dig into this now. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, is with us to continue to dig into this one. It's been a while since we talked about it. How big of a blow is this to the prosecution, or is it not, to the murder charges that they're trying to bring against Corey Richens?
You know, it's clearly significant, and I've said it earlier today, but a case might look really good on paper, but then once you get closer to trial, some things can go south. Some things can turn on you that you don't expect. Here, we have a witness recanting which damages the government's case. That witness was the alleged initial source of the toxin that Corey Richens used to kill her husband. So that's a problem. It messes up the sequence of events, sort of that's a sequential chain. But that being said, there's a lot of other significant evidence that even if this dude is being shifty about what he did, that doesn't take away from the fact of what was found in the alleged victim's body and the other pieces of evidence you mentioned. So I think the case is still reasonably strong, but this is a blow.
Yeah. Go ahead, Tony.
No, I just said, yeah, it certainly does deal one. Go ahead.
I'm curious, it's been a while since we've talked about this case. What does the authorship of her book have to do with any sort of defense? Does that come into play that, look, she's feeling so much trauma over losing her husband that she wrote this book with her children? This couldn't be a woman who allegedly killed her husband. How does that book play into this? And I know we've probably have covered this at some point a long time ago, but it's been a while.
Stacey, I think both sides are going to have their own interpretations of the book and what it means for the case. On the prosecution side, hey, what's a really smart way if you killed your husband but really don't want to be blamed for it and want to actually come out, smelling like roses from that? You write this kind of book where you're trying to sort of pacify a child based on their father's death and make things all better. If you're the defense, you say, hey, this was a sincere expression from a widow who just lost her husband, who is now being blamed, who has subsequently been blamed for that. But this was these were her thoughts in terms of how to show compassion for her child and help the child adjust and help other kids adjust. That's a good thing. So that there were multiple interpretations. Will depend on which one the jury accepts.
When someone recants their testimony like this, he gave a reason. He said, I was in recovery. I was, fresh into it at that moment in time. And yes, I said that, but it wasn't accurate at that moment in time. Okay. I mean, a lot of people based a lot of decisions on your testimony at that moment in time. Why did you change it now? Why did you not know it at that moment in time. I mean, this is a story, this is a case where there's already a lot of accusations of Corey trying to steer this case from behind bars with the wag the dog letter, things of that nature, trying to get people to say things certain ways. At least if we're to read the tea leaves that way, and it is what the state is saying it was about, and not just some sort of plot for a book that she was writing, which would be the worst book in the world. So I guess, how do we know what the motive truly is behind recanting that testimony? And do they dig into that at all? Can they dig into that at all? Or is it just, well, that's what this person says. It holds no more weight than, I guess, him saying, you know, he did deal the fentanyl versus not dealing the fentanyl. Again, it's just his words one way or the other.
Those motivations will certainly be inquired into during the jury trial phase by defense. And look, you know, human beings are often terribly inconsistent. We like to think that, you know, we have this case file and it says, you know, this person said this and that helps our case and he's going to say that at trial and things are going to be great. But human beings are all over the place in terms of their statements, in terms of positions, shifting opinions, different motivations, and all those things come into play. The question will be, do those variances give rise to some sort of doubt that is an approximation of reasonable doubt? I don't think alone that recantation does that, but if defense can use that in addition to other inconsistencies, prosecutors might have a problem.
The absence of any recovered fentanyl pills tied to Corey has been repeatedly reported in this. But we have to remember the context of the case, too. Corey was a free woman for quite some time after this. Mm-hmm. She had a book. She was doing TV appearances on the local, you know, Good Morning, you know, wherever, you know, shows. And so no fentanyl recovered at, yeah, I mean, later. There's plenty of time to get rid of fentanyl if you had any in the house. Right. You know, there wasn't like we're busting down the doors right after he died. What do you have here? How strong of an argument is it by the defense of, well, you didn't find any fentanyl in the house? Like, yeah, I mean, you probably didn't find any, you know, murder weapons and bloody gloves and shit in somebody's house either if they committed a crime like that and you arrest them several months later.
All right. You know, I think it's not terribly significant for the defense, something they'll put forward. But gosh, when a person commits a crime, it's reasonable to think that they might try to cover their tracks, that they might try to dispose of evidence that could link them to that crime. And especially when you have this interval of time that Corey Richards had, she had many opportunities to do that. And so I think the prosecution will be able to sort of neutralize that fact by saying, yeah, but, you know, if a person did this, it's reasonable to think they would have made sure there was no evidence, you know, sitting in their dresser drawer of what is essentially the murder weapon in this case.
What about the earlier accusations? And again, there is no toxicology to show that any of it is true. There was the accusations that on Valentine's Day, she tried to poison one of his sandwiches. And that was relayed through, you know, basically him telling a family member or friend, I forgot which it was, that, you know, I think she might be trying to kill me. If anything ever happens to me, you know, look at her. I'm just kind of paraphrasing what was allegedly communicated there.
Isn't that the biggest witness of all?
Well, is it? Or look, you can look at it another way, too. Okay, answer that question first, because I'm going to play devil's advocate here in a second. Go ahead.
Yeah, so as a general rule, if someone is going to present a statement of the defendant at trial that's incriminating, they've got to do that at trial. Well, the statement, the declarant of the statement is deceased. He's not going to testify at trial. And so there arises potentially a confrontation clause issue under the Sixth Amendment, whereby the defense can't cross-examine on this alleged statement. You know, what did he exactly say? What were his exact words? To whom did he say it? Under what circumstances? All of these aspects. And so there's a chance that the judge doesn't let it in. But if the judge does let it in, it shows a potential pattern of poisoning, which is extremely damning to the defense. We saw that in the James Craig Dennis case. Mm-hmm. In Colorado, there was a similar pattern, and he's behind bars for life.
It's a pattern, according to him. And again, he's dead. He can't talk about it. I'm playing devil's advocate here. Or it could be showing a pattern of paranoia. It could be showing a pattern of someone who thinks that their wife is out to kill them and they're not, and is talking to their friends and family about it. And it could be showing, you know, if you're in that situation, if you're Corey, and you have a spouse that's not basing, you know, there's cognitive distortions going on that are telling them that your wife is doing this, that would be a hellish type scenario to be living under. If you were Corey and your husband is kind of feeling these ways or thinking those sort of ways, and you know, and then you add, well, why are they thinking these sort of ways? Well, is there an underlying drug problem going on as well?
Yeah, you know, it's a fair question.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like this. I mean, there could be other explanations other than just that. There is mental illness. There's disorder. I have no idea. I have no idea what was going on with him. I don't know. You know, it doesn't mean it was always diagnosed or always checked out or recognized. Again, it would be her argument against everybody else's. I'm not trying to give her, you know, here's try this one, Corey. But I don't know. It's not a crazy thing to think about.
Oh, sure. You know, there are fabrications all the time. There are inaccurate accusations. Sometimes they are innocent. Sometimes they are malicious. And so all of those things could potentially explain such a statement. And that's why it's so difficult to have such a statement admitted at trial, because the decedent isn't there to be questioned, to ask about, hey, you know, were you struggling with drugs yourself at the time? Were you struggling with mental illness at the time? Those sort of things. I'm not saying he was, and I'm not saying that somehow absolves Corey Richens of the accusations, but I'm just saying that these are important questions when it comes to the value and weight of such a statement from a person who's no longer with us.
Yeah, I mean, and again, this is another one of those cases too, where people are looking and going, well, I certainly wouldn't do that, like having a party at the house that you're husband said, no, you shouldn't be buying. This is a bad investment for us. And the second he's dead, you're like popping bottles.
It was pretty much the second after. Yeah. It was a couple days, maybe in the next day or 2 days.
It's a little odd, a little strange, but so does, you know, fireworks at your husband's funeral, you know, but again, it doesn't necessarily mean that we know what the hell is going on in that person's mind. They could just be dealing with things extremely differently than we are, for whatever reason that may be. It's just how they deal with it. There's personality disorder. There's mental illness. There's whatever it may be. Who the hell knows? It's who they are. And that person is not you. So it's another one of those, well, that's how they are. But does it mean anything?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've seen folks who have gone through tragedy, and some of them try their best to maintain a sense of normalcy, to maintain sort of a normal presentation to their friends, to their family. They try to keep living their lives. Sometimes they're in denial. Sometimes it's a coping strategy to try to get past this horrible thing in their life. And all of that can be completely innocent. Now, on the other hand, it can be very incriminating when, you know, it appears that a person has moved on so quickly that the inference that some could draw is this person wasn't that bummed out by her partner dying. And oh, look, there's these other pieces of evidence that kind of suggest that she might have had a hand in that. When you put those together in a totality, that's when the jury is hopefully going to see the real truth, whatever that truth is.
And look, I'm going to throw this other horrible one in here too for this case. Again, I know nothing about them. I have no idea what their relationship was like. I have no idea what he was like. Let's say this was just a really miserable relationship, and they weren't very happy together. I mean, there is some evidence of that, at least if you're to believe the testimony, the statements that have been given by family members, where, you know, it sounds like he's, you know, paranoid that he might get killed by his wife. If you're in a very unhealthy relationship on both sides, and let's say she didn't do it, let's say this all just looks really, really horrible, but he does die of this overdose, maybe by his own hand and maybe by accident, not intentional, and he's dead. But for a second, let's say you're living with a spouse that you detest, that life is a living hell for whatever reason, whether it's their fault, your fault, a combination of faults, whatever, you're just in a miserable state, and they die. Suddenly, unexpected, and you had nothing to do with it. And maybe you're kind of relieved because that fucking nightmare is over. Wouldn't be the way everybody reacts, but I can certainly think of several people who would or could that are not evil human beings that, you know, if you're going through hell and the relationship is already heading towards a divorce and this ends up being the way out through a horrible accident, not everybody is going to be, oh my God, this is the worst thing in the world, if you were already wanting out of that relationship. And it also doesn't mean you murdered them.
Right.
Totally. And I think that that's why we have to be cautious in terms of how much weight we're placing in these human reactions like this that can run the gamut. There is a whole spectrum of how a human being could react to such an event and its influence, like you said, based on the relationship dynamics, based on the circumstances of the person, based on any number of things. And so we've got to be careful. It's the same thing with Erica Kirk. You know, some people raise some eyebrows and that's okay, but in terms of her reaction, but I think we got to be careful in terms of how much weight we place in it, because it's so unpredictable how a human being might respond, especially under such grave circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, completely. I want to talk about the reason that the recantation is getting so much attention right now from the individual who says, you know, I didn't ever sell fentanyl, I was selling oxy, was because the accusation is that this recantation took place in April, and we're in October, and the defense is saying, we just found out about this now, and they're saying, you know, piece of evidence, exculpatory piece of evidence here, we're just finding out about this now. They're arguing it could be a Brady violation. Is it, or is it the defense, you know, we're going to say it's a Brady violation. It sure kind of looks like it could be. That's a big deal to not turn over a piece like this. Is it not, or are they doing their job and, you know, they're playing this to the media, but making it bigger than it actually is?
Well, I think constitutionally, it's a significant problem. Yeah. As you alluded to, there are cases, including the Brady case and its progeny, which essentially state if there is evidence that tends to negate the guilt of the defendant and the government has this in their possession, not only do they have to turn it over, but they have to take reasonable measures to turn it over promptly. It's not something you can kind of hold close to the vest until the 11th hour and then say, oh, surprise. So I think that that's a problem. They should have turned it over before. I can't think of a good explanation why they didn't. And if I was defense, I'd be raising hell about it. Absolutely. Now, is it a complete game changer? Does it prove she's not guilty? No, it doesn't prove that. But it is a material withholding of exculpatory information. And we're talking about a level playing field. We're talking about a murder case. That's a big violation on behalf of the prosecution. In terms of what the remedy is going to be, that's what the judge will have to decide.
Another thing that's being emphasized so much is the financial motive in this case, that there was a lot of debt, and usually the equation goes debt plus motive equals guilt. And that obviously is not always the case. And I question that a little bit, especially when we're talking about debt. It's not like there was, you know, a lot to necessarily gain here other than control and her ability to get that house. You know, and when her husband said, no, honey, we're not going to put our money towards that. You have that there. But when we're talking about debt, wouldn't you be better served to have the spouse still alive and then get divorced and then split that debt rather than have it all pile on your ass when your husband's now dead? Because that's simply what takes place in this scenario.
Unless the life insurance policy was such that it would clear out that debt.
I think that's being questioned, though, too. And I don't know what was there in terms of policies.
Yeah, you know, all important considerations. But yeah, I think you raise a good point that there'd be better ways to address the debt than just offing your husband. However, if there were other motivations involved in addition to that, and there was a way to secure life insurance policy and to benefit one's own monetary position through the death of their spouse, then that could be seen in that incriminating light. But I think debt is used oftentimes in these cases, and there's not always the best logical connection to, oh, they were in debt. That means he killed her. Well, why does there's a bit of a non sequitur there, and the prosecution is going to have to sort of fill in that gap.
Yeah, it's kind of going to play it out, like, what really is Evan? And it doesn't mean like they didn't kill them thinking this was a great idea and not really playing it out in their mind going, wait a second, that's not a great idea. But I mean, who knows? I want to ask you this as an attorney, and we hear these phrases thrown around so much of, oh my gosh, there's terabytes and terabytes and terabytes of data to go through. 11 terabytes in this case. And yeah, that does sound like a lot on paper. Is that a lot? I mean, there's large files. You know, video can take up a terabyte if you have a lot of video in like one single file. And we don't know what's all in that. When you see that, when you see that being thrown out there of all this, these terabytes of data you have to go through, what are we actually talking about when you as an attorney get that dump of data? How difficult is that to truly go through today? I know years ago, probably a different story without the tools that exist. But today, what does it really mean?
You know, I can give an example from a recent homicide case that I handled on the defense side, and the client has authorized me to disclose this. So there were more than 2 terabytes of data from a digital download from multiple devices, like I think 4 devices or so. And that contained 120,000 emails, about 100,000+ text messages. And granted, you know, I didn't have to go through all of those. I didn't have to go through the emails that were 10 years old because they had such a attenuated relationship with the alleged event. So you kind of have to be strategic in how you go about it. You can hire digital forensic analysts. There are tools, like you said, including AI tools that can summarize evidence. Mm-hmm. But you got to be careful about that because you don't want to miss something and you don't want to draw a wrong conclusion based on the AI hallucination or something like that. Mm-hmm. So that was that case that there were more than 2 terabytes. Terabytes is a substantial amount, but you know, they've had months, they have a defense team. These are just things that they have to get through, and so they're gonna have to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I know I don't use the tools, obviously. I'm not an attorney. I have touched them a few times, you know, when working on some cases. But I've been kind of blown away by some of it, like, oh my God, you could really parse out a lot of information really quick. I mean, just give us some insight into some of the tools that can be used in terms of AI finding data. When you need to find something about a phone call in a case, you no longer have to have, you know, 50 legal assistants combing through everything. You can type it in and boom, boom, boom. Here's what we found. I mean, it can be that easy today, can it not?
Oh, it can. And in addition to criminal defense, I also do some personal injury work. Mm-hmm. And so in those cases, we have thousands upon thousands of pages of medical records,
yeah,
including prior records, all sorts of stuff. And there are AI systems that can digest that very quickly and give. And you could say, hey, can you list the most significant medical procedures or even medical events in this case when we have treatment that has spanned years and years, and it can give it to you in a few minutes. And so there are ways to really be efficient and shorten the time it takes to review all of those things and distill the most salient points.
Mm-hmm. We are, what, like 4 months out from trial on this, supposedly? It's roughly what I think we're talking about here. She is arguing, Corey Richens is saying, you know, because of this, because of the potential Brady violation here, I should be out on bail until then. Is that a strong argument based on what we've learned?
I don't think so, in part because when a judge sees a potential Brady violation like this, the judge has to decide, what's the remedy going to be? Am I going to dismiss the whole case? Am I going to suppress evidence? Am I going to do something else? But usually that remedy has to be tied in some way to the nature of the violation, the nature of the evidence that was withheld. So you can't, I don't think it really logically follows to say, hey, the prosecution withheld this evidence about this recanted testimony. Let me go be out of custody and live a normal life until the trial. That remedy is not tailored to the nature of the violation. So I think that is a large ask for the judge, and I don't think the judge is likely to grant it.
It's going to be fascinating as this one gets closer. And I'm really hoping for her next book. I like to read that first one all the time. I'm on chapter one because there's only one chapter and I'm on the second page now. I've C-Spot Run is how it starts. It's a good one. I highly recommend it. Available wherever you get books. Is it still out there? Can you buy it on Amazon?
Not, no,
it's now. Oh, it's gone. Ah, we should make an AI version of it. Make a new version. Eric Faddis, as always, thanks for coming on and giving us your insight into these cases. Invaluable, as always. Really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
If you have an opinion on this, you want to get your thoughts out there, please let us know it in the comment section on YouTube. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. You'll find us there, and you can have your voice be heard as well. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're watching or listening as well. Until next time, for Stacey and Todd and Eric, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.